Who's this?
It's Ronnie Dyson. I'm not saying I want to change you. This was about 1969 or 70, somewhere.
The golden age.
What was so golden about 1969 or 70?
I don't know. I was.
Well, I do. I was 16 years old, so.
I was older than that.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That's Fridays with Sandy Williams. And listen, we got a lot to talk about. Let's go to the phone lines and Gary from Sussex. Hey, good morning, Gary. How you doing? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Hi, Earl, Sandy. You know me, when I call up, I don't really argue. I just try to tell you how I look at things.
That's what this is, opinion, guys, man. It's opinion. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. I'm not CJ, so just don't start yelling at me.
I'm not,
I don't conduct myself like CJ.
Right.
Right. Go ahead.
Even though I like CJ, and I love that he calls up. I love listening to him, but he doesn't. He talks over everybody all
okay,
the time.
Okay, let's get past CJ, cool. Let's get past CJ.
So I'm going to talk about what you guys were talking about last hour about guns. Now, I don't know. You don't even have to say yes or no, but I have a concealed carry permit. I don't know if you guys do or not.
No, I don't. Okay? I don't own a gun.
What about Sandy?
No, I have shotguns for hunting, but certainly not a pistol.
But you don't have a concealed carry permit?
No, gosh, no. I'm just not. My personal view is that I don't think that my having a gun would end up with that gun being used in any sort of fruitful way. And I think the downside of having a pistol around would be far greater than the potential upside. So that's my view. You know, that's my opinion. But
yeah. You asked Gary. You were saying what would happen if.
Exactly.
If
so
what?
The thing is, I'm a
what would happen
I'm a
if what? Okay, go ahead.
Oh, I'm a heating contractor, and what I do is I carry a gun. If I'm working in an area that I don't feel safe, that I'll carry with me. Otherwise, I just leave it locked up in my truck. All right. Now the thing is, my opinion is that if they, I know you're going to start yelling at me, so let me. Just
I'm not going to start
if
yelling.
If they would enforce the laws on people that should not be carrying a gun and throw them in jail for what, you know, a year or 2 years for carrying a gun when you're not supposed to be, there'd be less problems. When was the last time that there was an incident, somebody got shot by a person who legally carried a gun legally and it was not a criminal? I mean, I can't remember the last time I heard anybody with a concealed carry permit shooting somebody or shooting somebody not just to defend himself, but to murder them as a crime, you know?
Okay,
it just doesn't happen.
Well, Gary, I would agree with you about that, but that might be evidence of the fact that that having a concealed weapon isn't very frequently ever a fruitful use. It's never fruitfully used in defense against a crime, because in the very rare circumstance when it is, it does make big news. So we find out that someone in Texas was shot a perpetrator in defense. But, you know, that's one, and there's 400 million guns out there. And that's one of the times it was used that way. And you carry a concealed gun, which doesn't make it a deterrent for anyone because they don't know you're carrying it, right? So when you're in a community where you don't trust, where you feel that you're endangered, you have a concealed gun. The people don't know you have it, so that's not deterring them from taking action against you, but you've never had to use it. So far, your pistol has given you comfort, but it hasn't really served as a deterrent because no one knows you have it. So again, I'm trying to look at the costs and benefits of pistols, and you know the most frequent person to get killed by a pistol owned is the owner.
So Gary, yeah. Go ahead, Gary.
Wait just a minute.
But the thing is, Sandy, you're speculating on whether I need to use it. One time, I was robbed at knife point, and I did use my gun. I didn't shoot the guy or anything like that. turned out later on that the guy just got out of prison for murder. And believe it or not, I know you're going to think this is crazy, but after we talked for about 15, 20 minutes, we went over to McDonald's and had lunch.
Gary, let me say this again.
So it turned out really well.
I know, but let me say this again. The conversation was not, it was about the fact that in Florida, they're talking about permitless carrying, that you don't need a permit to carry a gun.
But if you don't,
I didn't interrupt you. Somehow, the conversation morphed into now concealed carry. That's not what this conversation was about, but you've changed it to something else. What are your thoughts about Gary? What are your thoughts about permitless carry, which is what they're doing? In Florida, you have a permit to carry a gun. Do you agree with the fact that they should allow people to carry guns without permits?
But the thing is, they're not going to give guns to people who are criminals down in Florida. They still have background checks on you. They're not going to give a gun to somebody who goes out there and threatens and beats his wife up. They're not going to do that. They're not going to give it to criminals.
They aren't going to give guns to people who've been convicted of crimes, or in most states. Okay, but that universe is not the universe that includes all the potential people who will misuse guns if they have access to them. And, you know, I think we just sit on the other. I think it is true that there is a divide between people who believe in handguns as you do, as being a positive, and those who fear that the spread of the availability of guns has more downside than upside. I mean, I don't think anyone would disagree with the premise that someone who's armed with a pistol in the circumstance of being robbed might be better off having the pistol than not having it. Although there's even proof of the fact that even when people are armed, their capacity to use it in defense of themselves is limited.
So this argument is that constitutional carry would allow gun owners to carry them openly in public without a permit. This is what they are asking for. They're saying this is really what constitutional carry is. Therefore, none of us have to have a permit. We should be able to carry our guns. And I don't know, Sandy, there's certainly some financial dollars that come along with permits. I don't think that's what they're talking about. They're talking about just freeing these people to do basically what they want to do.
Well, I think there is some fear amongst those who are very fixated on the Second Amendment that having permits for guns allows the government
to trace you,
to have a list of people who have guns, and somehow that will end up turning around on people with guns. I don't know. I mean, I just think that America is one of the only countries in the world that has become so fixated on guns as to make it the subject of a great deal of angst and a great deal of conversation and political rancor. And it's too bad. I think America probably does divide into those who believe that guns are important and those who believe the danger of guns overrides any positive value they might have in the circumstance of being used outside of the range of hunting. I'm not sure we can settle this one, Gary, in terms of reaching across the aisle and persuading either one of us of a different belief than we have.
So the nation is divided down the middle, just like it is Democrat, Republican. It's divided down the middle with people who look at guns and their rights to own and have guns.
Well, what's surprising is that the polling on this would suggest that it's even possible that more people are against than are in favor of it, in spite of the fact that we have 1.5 guns per person in this country, so that there are people, obviously, who own many guns and some people who own no guns, and that opinions about guns are disproportionate to are not in proportion to the political support that guns
You're
have.
You're right in that, Sandy, but what I don't and have never understood is how in majority rule kind of thing, the majority of the American people and their voices on the guns are not being are not resonating.
Well, this has to do with the power of special interests and the power, and by special interest, that kind of
lobbies, right.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it has to do with the power of a particularly strong interest, okay? Let's not call it a special interest. And people who have a strong interest, who might be a material minority, are able to exert that power in the context of, for instance, primary elections. And so they can back someone in a primary and unseat an incumbent. So incumbents in this country are worried about having to face opposition, particularly in order to secure the renomination to their post. So in most circumstances, the power that's exerted by those in favor of guns is exerted at that level. The NRA exerts a great deal of political power in the context of local elections, and in particular in the context of primary elections. And it's that power that creates disproportionate power as compared to a polling, for instance, of the people. I think that's the case.
I think you're 100% accurate. And listen, we've got to go to break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Friday. This Friday's with Sandy Williams. We got to go to a break. We'll be right back.
These guys went to Columbia College when I was in law school.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, I just remember the cleanness of the song, right? And the fact that during the Vietnam War in 1968 and all of the unrest, and this came out, and the cleanness of their voices, right?
Yeah.
Like a bridge over trouble. All right, welcome back, Sandy. You want to say something?
No. Well, I just think the music of during Vietnam is kind of remarkable in that the number of songs that have endured, which when you go back in time, you realize were really either very thoughtful mourning songs, MOURNING,
right,
mourning songs, or anti-war songs, political statements, and how deep the political situation ran in terms of the anti-war sentiment and how long it took us to end the war in spite of that.
Well, you know, those songs stuck with me all this time. And even though I haven't heard them for many, many years, as I was kind of chronicling through different songs, those songs impacted me in a way, and that's why we're, you know. Welcome back, anyway, to the Erlinger Show.
Actually, but one thing I was interested in mentioning briefly on the show, I haven't mentioned this.
Well, let's go in first.
Okay.
Welcome back to the Erlinger Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, Texas, at that same number. It's Friday. Friday's with Sandy Williams. And go ahead, Sandy.
Well, the anti-war thing brought up in my mind. There was a fellow named George Kennan. And George was very famous in American history for having written what became known as the Long Telegram or Telegram X, in which in 1949 he outlined the policy. He was in the State Department and was one of the people, was a policy wonk. Interestingly, he grew up in Shorewood, Wisconsin, went to the military academy out here in Delafield, to high school, went on to Princeton. So he was a Milwaukee native who achieved this fame for being the founder of the containment policy, which was in this long telegram that was the basis for essentially the Cold War containment policy that the United States used vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. And he was long known and most famous for being the father of that. But interestingly, he went to the Institute of Advanced Studies at Princeton, and from there he continued to – he was born in 1904, died in 2005, and lived through a whole bunch of what's going on now. And during Vietnam, he was admonishing the United States by saying that we shouldn't be in Vietnam, that it wasn't an area of real and substantial interest to the United States. We had no purpose behind expending all of our treasure and our international reputation there, and was an anti-war person from the very beginning in terms of trying to establish what the U.S. policy ought to be in Vietnam. And by the same token, in the 1990s, when the United States decided to support NATO and its expansion of NATO to the old Warsaw Pact countries like Poland and Hungary and Romania, he was admonishing the United States against that, saying that we should not be expanding and threatening Russia with the expansion of NATO, because it was going to create an international tension that didn't have to occur because of the historical situation of Russia, the Romanov Republic, the USSR, and these countries. And so this guy, who was exceedingly wise, was not a pro-Russian person. He was the one who started the Cold War notions. And so he's just part of, I think, a rhetoric and an intellectual analysis that I would ascribe to that doesn't embrace the way America has gone about things, which ultimately has led to the Ukrainian war.
So we're there now. Let's have at it. I had conversations, Sandy, yesterday with about three or four good friends about what is taking place in Ukraine a year later. And to hear them speak, we made a commitment to Ukraine. We're not going to turn and run. It doesn't matter. What do we look like if we don't live up to our word? We're the United States of America. And there are people who are using that kind of rhetoric, Sandy, as if, you know, this is, you made a commitment to your next door neighbor that you are going to defend his property. They don't understand the magnitude of where this is can head quickly, Sandy, and what can wind up happening. And you correct me if I'm wrong, this is probably one of the most dangerous times that we have faced in this nation since, what, World War II?
Since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the problem with this one is that the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred in a period when there was a hotline telephone between the Kremlin and the White House, and there was a set of game rules about how the game would be played, and we don't have that right now.
So we got to go to break. So when we come back, we'll continue that conversation. I'm interested in having it with you, Sandy, and the listening audience. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. So do you.
I was born and raised down in Alabama on a farm way back up in the woods. I was so ragged that folks used to call me Patches. Papa used to tease me about it, cause deep down inside he was hurt cause he'd done all he could. My papa was a great old man. I can see him with a shovel in his hand. See, education he never had. He did wonders when the times got bad. The little money from the crops he raised barely paid the bills we made. Oh, life had kicked him down to the ground. When he tried to get up, life would kick him back down. One day, Papa called me to his dying bed, put his hands on my shoulder, then in tears he said, Patches, I'm depending on you, son, to pull the family through. My son, it's all left up.
Patches, Earl, I'm going to call you Patches.
Patches, Clarence Carter, a blind guy who,
2 days later, Papa
made a lot of great songs.
I became a man that day. So I told Mama I was gonna quit school, but she said that was Daddy's strictest rule. So every morning before I went to school, I fed the chickens and I chopped wood too. Sometimes I felt that I couldn't go on. I wanted to leave, just run.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That's Fridays with Sandy Williams. So, Sandy, we're talking about Ukraine and a year into this war. And before we go to you, Sandy, Calvin wanted to add something. Calvin?
Yeah. So I was just wondering, in relation to the war in Ukraine and our relations with Russia. So prior, in the lead up to World War One, Great Britain had a policy of, and now I'm not comparing Russia to Nazi Germany by any means, but Great Britain had the policy of appeasement with...
That was World War II, Calvin.
World War II, my bad. That's what I meant. Yeah. With World War II, of allowing them to expand their territory kind of unfettered. Do you see any parallels with that and United States pulling out of Ukraine and allowing Russia to gain that territory?
There's a bunch in that. What you're talking about is Neville Chamberlain, and there was the negotiation that was ongoing when Hitler was saying that he wanted to annex the Sudetenland. The Sudetenland is part of what is now Czechoslovakia. Sudetenland had a bunch of German speakers in it, and the discussion at that time sounded a lot like the Russian discussion now about wanting to annex the Donbas. In light of all the Russian speakers there, and then Neville Chamberlain basically agreed to the annexation, thinking that would staunch the German expansion, and that was all that Hitler wanted. But it turned out that he very quickly moved on Poland and did other things, and so that was viewed as a tremendous mistake that gave Germany the head of steam and sanctified what they were doing. Is it the same now? I seriously don't think so, but obviously there are some who would want to draw that parallel. But I wanted to start out the conversation with Ukraine by saying, look, my heart is entirely for the Ukrainians. The Russians have attacked them. It is a group of people that are under assault. They are defending themselves and dying in massive numbers, throwing themselves in support of their government's defense of a geographic area against the Russians, and it's hard not to have your heart be exactly for them. And every time I read about a battle or I read about the front lines and what's going on there, I'm wishing them success and I'm wishing the Russians failure in this process. But that begs the question of what is the American interest here? How did this thing start? Why did it start? What is Russia's impulse? And is that impulse something that we should recognize, and does it endanger other people, other places? And I think that Putin has made very clear for over a decade what his situation and position is with respect to the old Warsaw Pact area, but in particular, mainly the particular Russian speaking, ethnic Russian speaking portions of it, which are Belarus, Ukraine, and that area, Moldova might be included in that, and his desire not to annex those places, but to have them become a part of the alliance that the Russian Federation has founded, that has included a number of the old USSR republics, which include Kazakhstan, Georgia, and a number of other countries. And we watched this unfold with Georgia and decided that the American interest was not going to be damaged and the world interest was not going to be damaged by Georgia maintaining its separate nation status but forming a strong alliance with Russia, because there was a recognition of the hegemony, the so-called area sphere of political influence and power that existed for the Russian Federation, that included these places. And everyone has recognized that it included Ukraine. And so what George Kennan was saying back in the 1990s was that the U.S. real interest was not going to be represented by expanding NATO and pushing Russia into a dangerous corner, a corner they would perceive as dangerous, when we could leave them in a situation where if their hegemony was recognized, they would recognize the sanctity of the countries surrounding them, only requiring that those countries essentially operate in alliance with them, much the way the United States operates in the Western Hemisphere and even in Western Europe.
But Sandy, your in-depth assessment is not matched by many Americans. They don't know that history. And Calvin kind of pointed out us pulling out. We're not in. Well, there are people who somehow seem to think that we're in this war.
Well, what's happened, and I was saying this off the air, is that first of all, there's two ways to look at this. There's one is what has gone on over the past year, and what has gone over the past year and even the period prior to that, and that's really what led up to the war, was the United States giving promise to Ukraine that we would provide them with the wherewithal to fight Russia and to not essentially knuckle under to Russia in negotiations over the policies that they would adopt, Russia being interested in particular that Ukraine not enter NATO and not be the geographic place where NATO would have missiles and military bases that would be within essentially Russia's geographic area. And so we, on the other hand, gave constant lip service to supporting Ukraine. And then, as I mentioned on Monday, we signed this strategic charter agreement on November 10th of 2021, signed by Blinken, in which it read like a treaty, in which we basically promised Ukraine all kinds of support to support their defense of their geography. And we gave them essentially the Dutch courage to negotiate and to say no to Russia with respect to Russia's demands for a negotiation that would have recognized the sanctity of the Ukrainian government, but would have required a sympathetic set of processes to be ongoing. Number one, the recognition of the annexation of Crimea and the treatment of the Donbas region, both of which were actually part of the Russian Republic until 1954, when Khrushchev, who was a Ukrainian, decided to cede those over to the Ukrainian Republic. It was much like changing the boundary between Texas and Oklahoma in the context in which it was done. And so, you know, there's a history there. And we pushed the buttons that gave Ukraine the capacity to say no. And then we have given them the armaments in the meantime to fight a battle they didn't capitulate in 2 weeks, which would have involved very little bloodshed, and which was what everyone was prognosticating at the time of the invasion. Instead of capitulating, they have fought, and now we are giving them the weaponry to essentially fight to the last Ukrainian. But we have at the same time announced that it is not in our national interest to send troops there or to otherwise give them the weaponry to allow them to have an offensive war that would create essentially a parity with Russia in the war.
Well, let's do this, because Steve is on the line, and he wants to challenge you on some of those things. Steve, good morning. You say what?
Good morning, my friend. Well, I listen with interest to Sandy's analysis, but as amazing as it is, people actually disagree. And one of the main persons that disagrees with his analysis is President Joe Biden. First of all, this area, the Donbass and the Crimea, is Ukrainian territory, period. It's not Russia's. They have no right to it whatsoever. And any time you want to go back in history and say, well, it was once upon a time, we could cherry pick all kinds of places all across the globe that were one time somebody else's territory. This was Ukraine. This is Ukrainian territory. They have every right to it back, and they have every right to fight to get it back. Now, Joe Biden, fortunately, is brave enough and has the courage to allow Ukraine to defend itself. We, the United States, don't have boots on the ground, but we are providing a whole bunch of weapons, not to mention logistical support. At some point in time, it might come to boots on the ground, but I doubt it because Ukraine's army is proving themselves to be more than capable if they have the means to defend themselves. To go back to the beginning of Sandy's argument about NATO expanding toward Russia, first of all, Ukraine never filled out an accusation to be part of NATO until after they were invaded. And they were talking about joining NATO, but they talked about it because they were in fear of a Russian military invasion, which turned out to be a justifiable fear. This entire war has been started by Putin and Moscow. And if they retreat to the international recognized borders of Russia and get out of Ukraine, the war could end tomorrow. It is Putin who has started this war. He is the cause of this war. And every phony baloney reason that you come up with why he is justified to do it or should do it or has a reasonable cause for it doesn't hold any water whatsoever and wilts away like wet noodles.
Well, Steve, I don't disagree at all with you that I disagree with Joe Biden and that there are plenty of people out there who disagree with my view and my worldview. I think I do agree with the likes of Henry Kissinger who've analyzed this and have tried to look at it from the standpoint of what is the real interest of America, and based on that real interest of America, what should our policies have been and what should they be now? Things have become much more complicated now, and the outcome of the war is, you know, the end game is a very difficult thing to evaluate now, because the end game is what we're going to get to at some point. And what is that end game going to be? Some people would assert that they want the end game to be the weakening of Russia to the point where essentially it is reckoned by everyone as being a weak country without the military might that they would assert. Well, the weakened Russia that we're talking about has more nuclear missiles and has more military capability of weapons of mass destruction than we do. And so, yes, their ability in a land war might have well been put into question. But what we don't want to do is existentially back a country who's got that kind of armament into a situation where they might decide that why not use it because we're going out of existence if we don't. That's one terrible end game. Another end game is that, as some people would want, that Putin lose power in Russia and that he be replaced. And the only question then is, what's the process for replacing Putin, and who replaces him? There is no succession process in Russia. I don't at all suggest that the government of Russia is something I would want anyone else to emulate. I think Putin has cemented power there in a way that is very undemocratic. But because of that, there is no succession program. And right now, if the people who are watching Russia would suggest that if there was a power vacuum there, Evgeny Prigozhinov, the head of the Wagner Group, is probably the most politically likely to succeed him. And he has a mercenary army behind him to carry that weight. So do we want Do we want Evgeny Prigozhinov to be the head of Russia, and is that better than Putin? Undoubtedly not.
So KJ, hang on.
I'm going to after the break, we can go through, because this is a much longer set of possibilities.
Listen, we've got to go to a break. Our phone lines are open at 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, hey, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. Listen, it's the one-year anniversary of the Ukraine war. And whether or not, you know, we want to focus on it or not, it is without question an opportunity for people to stop and look at and focus on where it was a year ago, where it is now, and as Sandy always says, where it's headed. We've got Steve on the line. We'll let him.
Well, let me just say a little bit more in response to Steve, because Steve, you know, I emotionally agree with what you said, essentially almost 100%. It's hard not to be emotionally, strongly in support of the Ukrainian people and the position in this war and their defense against an invasion. But looking at it through American eyes and trying to figure out what the world interest and the American interest is here, you have to evaluate, number one, how we got here, and two, what the end game can be and what the possibilities are. And you know, you asserted that we have promised Ukraine all this support. The Constitution requires that promises that will get America into war in defense of other countries be embodied in treaties. We have not signed any treaty with Ukraine. We signed a treaty with NATO and the NATO countries, and that has Article 5, which is a commitment by the United States to use all of our blood and treasure in defense of each of the countries, and each of the countries makes that mutual promise. That was a treaty. We don't have a treaty with Ukraine. We have unilateral policies that have been adopted by presidents. And unfortunately, that's the way our foreign policy seems to evolve now, so that we have committed troops across the world, and many people have died, both Americans and those on the other side of the battle, have died as the result of presidential action and not treaty action. We haven't declared war for a very long time. We condemned Putin for not declaring war in his circumstance, but the fact is that almost all of our military actions lately have not been as a result of treaties, but have been presidential fiats. We have a situation in Ukraine where, if, for instance, Steve, you said that from the emotional support standpoint, if we really have committed to them, we would put troops on the ground, which we would do in support of a NATO nation. If we put troops on the ground and we have a war with Russia, what's the end game? If we defeat Russia in that context and Russia is defeated, what does a defeated Russia mean? And what is the implication to the world and to America of a defeated Russia? What happens to Russia? We should understand that the vacuum that was created in the USSR dissolved in 1991, we're still seeing the play out of that, okay? And I was reminded when I was looking at the history of this that the USSR was 75 years old when it imploded. The Civil War came upon the United States when it was 85 years old, about the same age. And the Civil War was not altogether unlike the implosion of the Soviet Union. And the Civil War ended up with the reunification of the country. But if it had not ended up in that fashion, and if we had envisioned the United States falling into its pieces the way Marjorie Taylor Greene wants it to do now, then what would have been the socioeconomic political outcome from that, and how would that fallout have occurred? How would New York and whatever country New York was in have dealt with Texas and whatever kind of alliances that Texas might want to enter into? I mean, the world is more complicated than we want to make it, and the demise of the Soviet Union was a far more complex situation than we ever gave it credit for being, and we have done nothing but probably aggravate the complexity into it by ignoring it as we proceeded after 1994. But we can't ignore right now what the end game will be for the war in Ukraine and what the implications are for that for the United States. And so
And for the world.
And so I guess we can play out all the options there. And I want you to know that when you play out the options, there aren't very many good ones other than a diplomatic settlement that looks a great deal like the diplomatic settlement that would have resolved this conflict probably in the beginning, which relates to the Crimea and the Donbas regions, which incidentally do have a much greater relationship to Russia and the Russian ethnicity. I mean, it isn't just that they speak Russian. It's that these people viewed themselves as Russians, just the way Texans probably would continue to view themselves as Texans. So anyway, but I've gone on at length. Steve, you have more?
Okay, Steve, quickly.
Well, he makes some good points, but every question he just asked is a question of open-ended speculation, and doesn't have an answer. Only time will answer that. I would say that the world is a little bit more less complicated than he would like to present it as. Freedom and liberty are worth fighting for. There are many places that the United States supports across the world that don't have a strategic interest to us. I'm not so sure Ukraine has a strategic interest to us, but it is in our interest that freedom and liberty remain in Ukraine, and they're able to defend themselves.
KJ, hang on. We've got to go to a break.
Wait, this is Steve.
I go to
Steve. Break. This is Steve.
I see. What did I say? Steve. Okay.
Yeah.
Steve, hang on, man. We got to go to a break. I see you, Sherman, CJ. We'll come back to all of you. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.
Well, you know that it would be